I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's July 4th, and we have a lot to talk about. If you've had a chance to listen to the last several episodes of the podcast, I probably don't have to tell you that I've had an opportunity to attend some remarkable and inspirational conferences and meetings over the past couple of months. Conferences range from the American Academy of Neurology's annual meeting to the Pathways to Cures Global Summit, the Consortium of Multiple Sclerosis Centers annual meeting, and the International Progressive MS Alliance Scientific Congress. I've tried to share highlights from each of those meetings on podcast episodes that I tried to make available as close as possible to the meeting dates themselves. I'll be the first to admit, it's been a busy time. This past weekend, I attended a different kind of meeting. It was a meeting of the National MS Society's Community Review of MS Research Committee. I just recently became a member of this committee. In fact, this was my first meeting. And I thought I'd tell you a little about what this committee does. The National MS Society is the largest private funder of MS research in the world. And when research proposals come into the society, they first receive their initial review by a program officer. Approved proposals are then forwarded for scientific review, and those proposals deemed as scientifically worthy by the Scientific Advisory Committee are forwarded to the Community Review of MS Research Committee. Now, the purpose of this committee is to ensure that the perspectives of people directly affected by MS are meaningfully included in the research grant decision-making process as another means to speed solutions for people living with MS and prevent MS for future generations. Each committee member receives the research proposals along with a description of each proposal that's written in easy-to-understand plain language. Committee members can attend sessions with MS Society scientific experts who summarize each project and answer questions. Then the committee rates each proposal based upon its relevance to people living with MS. Those ratings and more detailed comments from committee members are forwarded to the program officer for final review. And then a final package of research proposals is forwarded to the CEO of the National MS Society for a final funding decision. It was not only a great experience being with the other members of this committee, but I came away so impressed by their dedication to the work and the due diligence they apply in considering each research proposal. Now, this is a committee you may not have heard about before, and I think it's worth highlighting the way that the MS Society ensures that the voice of people affected by MS is part of the process in ensuring that the Society is investing in research that's most important, most relevant to the MS community. I can't begin to tell you how proud I am to be a part of this committee and be a participant in this process. You should also know that when I consider how relevant a particular research project might be, I consider all of your emails, your DMs, your texts, all of your suggestions for featuring one topic or another on future episodes of this podcast, and in my work on the committee, I do my best to take all of that as a reflection of your priorities. Well, I'm looking forward to our next committee meeting just a few months from now. I launched Real Talk MS because I wanted to highlight some of the amazing MS research that's being done in laboratories all around the world. And I wanted to make that research more accessible by making it a little easier for non-scientists to understand it. It may be hard for many of you to believe that it wasn't that long ago when there wasn't very much MS research being conducted anywhere. Just 30 years ago, there were no approved treatments for MS. That changed with the FDA approval of Betaseron, and today, 30 years later, there are more than 20 approved disease-modifying therapies that have already changed the definition of what it means to live with MS. Two of the top MS experts in the world have published a reflection looking back at the past 30 years and looking ahead at the challenges of solving MS that still remain. Joining me today are the co-authors of that reflection, Dr. Fred Lublin and Dr. Stephen Krieger. But before we get to my conversation with Drs. Lublin and Krieger, there are a few other things that you should know about. Conferences and meetings always provide a venue for scientists to share new research results and clinicians to report on new avenues in treatment. Sometimes these meetings can also serve as a launching pad for new ideas and new initiatives. As I've already shared with you, I found the Pathways to Cures Global Summit to be a historic event. Over the course of this two-day meeting, you couldn't help but feel a certain energy in the room. Something that went beyond the sharing of information was happening. And that sense that, hey, this is an important moment, well, it was borne out in the days that followed, when 10 MS organizations issued a first-of-its-kind historic announcement. Multiple sclerosis organizations from Australia, Canada, Denmark, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, the United Kingdom, the United States, and the MS International Federation jointly declared their collective commitment to a global research strategy to cure MS. Now, this collaborative effort is going to be guided by the Pathways to Cures roadmap that focuses on three goals, three distinct pathways: stopping MS disease progression by stopping the MS disease process itself, restoring lost function by reversing damage and symptoms, and ending MS through prevention. Now, under this global research strategy framework, these 10 organizations will complete a landscape analysis of MS research funding and infrastructure. They'll share national research plans and identify specific areas for collaboration and acceleration. They'll align individual and collective resources and develop a global research strategy framework to achieve the greatest impact. They'll create new joint initiatives to address the strategic gaps that remain in the Pathways to Cures roadmap. They'll engage people affected by MS in all aspects of the global research strategy framework, and they'll jointly report on their progress. Global scientific collaboration works. We've seen that firsthand in the unprecedented progress that's been driven by the International Progressive MS Alliance. Now we're about to see that same sort of collaborative approach applied to accelerating the work outlined in the Pathways to Cures initiative. As I hope you can tell, I'm excited about this announcement, and you'll be hearing more about it as this work gets underway. If you missed our coverage of the Pathways to Cures Global Summit, I'll invite you to check out episodes 297 and 298 of Real Talk MS, where you'll hear from the CEOs of half a dozen MS organizations, and you'll hear from a number of international MS experts who presented the status of research and identified remaining gaps in research that correlated directly with the goals of the Pathways to Cures initiative: to stop MS, restore lost function, and end MS forever. You'll find links to both of those episodes in today's show notes. Speaking of recent conferences and meetings, a few weeks ago at the International Progressive MS Alliance Scientific Congress in Vienna, I had the opportunity to host a live webcast that featured a conversation with the chair of the Alliance Scientific Steering Committee, Dr. Robert Fox, and two of the researchers whose work was funded by the Alliance through two Challenge Awards. Now, given the broad range of time zones that you all live in, I know that catching a live webcast can sometimes be difficult, if not impossible. But now, a video replay of that webcast is available. And you can find a link to that video replay of this live webcast directly from the International Progressive MS Alliance Scientific Congress in today's show notes. It's a worthwhile watch. And if you have a chance, I hope you invest some time in checking it out. Remyelination means restoring lost function. and finding a pathway to myelin repair is a primary goal in any number of studies and clinical trials taking place around the world. Now, a research team at UCLA has published the results of their study, which show that treating the mouse model of MS with estriol, a hormone that's naturally produced during pregnancy, reduced disease severity and promoted myelin repair in the cerebral cortex. That's a key brain region that's affected by MS. MS is characterized by damage and eventual loss of the myelin sheath that protects nerve fibers in the central nervous system. In this study, mice with the so-called mouse model of MS, called EAE, were divided into two groups. One group of mice was treated with estriol, and the other group received a placebo. The study showed that mice treated with estriol had significantly less myelin damage than the mice that received a placebo. The mice treated with estriol had significantly more oligodendrocytes, the cells that naturally make and repair myelin. And the production of cholesterol, which is the major component of myelin that's produced by these oligodendrocyte cells, well, it was significantly increased in the estriol-treated mice. Estriol is a form of estrogen that's made by the developing fetus and placenta during pregnancy. And given the positive results achieved in this study, the research team is calling for further studies to determine the potential for estriol as a treatment for women with MS. The team's entire study was conducted using only female mice, and the research team pointed out that although estriol could be given to men as a potential treatment for MS, it could also lead to unwanted side effects for men. I should also share my standard disclaimer with you, perhaps less of a disclaimer, more of a reminder that there is a massive difference between a mouse brain and a human brain. So there's still plenty of work to be done here, but this is certainly a step forward in understanding how estriol may play a role as a potential treatment for MS in women. Now, if you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Estriol has shown promise as a potential treatment for MS for quite some time, but prior studies hadn't analyzed its potential role in myelin repair. Now, one of the investigators in this study is Dr. Rhonda Vaskul, and Dr. Vaskul has spent the majority of her research career looking at connections between estrogen and MS. In 2021, I got together with my friend Brett Drummond from MS Translate in Australia for a conversation with Dr. Vaskul about her work. You'll find that interview in Real Talk MS episode number 189, and you'll find a link to that episode in today's show notes. There's more news to share when it comes to information about myelin repair. One of the things that has to be considered is that with multiple remyelination studies underway, having a way to accurately validate remyelination, to be able to conclusively measure myelin repair, well, it's absolutely necessary. Otherwise, scientists are left without a way to determine whether a potential method for repairing myelin actually works, and if it does work, how well it works. The good news here is that a research team at the University of California, San Francisco, has demonstrated a method for measuring remyelination that more accurately reflects myelin repair than other approaches and techniques. The team analyzed MRI data from the REBUILD clinical trial, and they were able to conclusively determine that the over-the-counter antihistamine, clemastine, demonstrated the ability to repair myelin. So let's break this down. First, the method for measuring myelin volume using MRI data is a game changer. This method involves using MRI techniques to measure the ratio of water trapped between the layers of myelin to the total water content of the brain. Changes in the structure of myelin that can be detected in MRI can alter this ratio, and this change, this alteration in that ratio, can act as a proxy or an accurate representation for myelin repair. Now that we know a little bit about the method, let's talk about the REBUILD clinical trial itself. This trial was focused on evaluating clemastine in people living with relapsing remitting MS who were on stable immune-modulating disease-modifying therapies. And the study results showed that clemastine helped to speed up electrical signals along the optic nerve that connects the eye to the brain. Now, although there was a change, the results of the trial were not statistically significant. However, in validating the results using MRI data, it became clear to the researchers that substantial myelin repair had occurred in the corpus callosum, which is a highly myelinated area of white matter that connects the two sides of the brain. Now, an unfortunate side effect of clemastine is drowsiness, which, given the fatigue factor that MS already carries with it, doesn't make clemastine an ideal therapy for someone living with MS. But this study validated an MRI technique that can be used in countless future clinical trials to conclusively, accurately determine whether myelin repair has occurred, and that is a major step forward. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. While we're talking about taking steps closer to identifying pathways to remyelination and restoring the physical function that's been lost to MS, it's hard to believe that just 30 years ago, there were no approved treatments for MS at all. That changed with the FDA approval of Betaseron, and today, with more than 20 approved disease-modifying therapies, the idea of living a full life with well-managed MS is a reality for thousands of people. We also know that there's still work to be done. Two of the top MS experts in the world have published a reflection looking back at the past 30 years and looking ahead at the challenges of solving MS that still remain. In a moment, you'll meet them both when we welcome my guests, Dr. Fred Lublin and Dr. Steven Krieger. 2023 marks the 30th anniversary of the first approved disease-modifying therapy for multiple sclerosis, and two clinician researchers who have each made extraordinary contributions to what we know about researching, diagnosing, and treating MS, Dr. Fred Lublin and Dr. Steven Krieger, have published an interesting reflection that explores how far we've come over the past 30 years and also calls out the challenges that lie ahead. It's a worthwhile read for everyone in the MS community, and if you have the Real Talk MS app installed on your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet, you'll find this paper waiting for you under the bonus content tab. Dr. Fred Lublin is the Saunders Family Professor of Neurology at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai and the director of the Corinne Goldsmith Dickinson Center for Multiple Sclerosis at Mount Sinai. Dr. Lublin participated in the development of that very first disease-modifying therapy approved for MS, and since that time, he's been involved in the development of nearly all of the DMTs available today. When you talk about relapsing remitting MS, secondary progressive MS, or primary progressive MS, you're actually using the clinical course descriptions of MS that were developed and then updated by Dr. Lublin and his colleagues. Dr. Steven Krieger is a clinician researcher at the Corinne Goldsmith Dickinson Center for Multiple Sclerosis at Mount Sinai. Dr. Krieger has developed a game-changing theory that MS is a single disease that can be considered as existing and evolving on a continuum rather than the four separate categories that neurologists have used to describe MS for the past couple of decades. If you have an iPad, I'd encourage you to visit the Apple App Store to download the free MS Topography app that Dr. Krieger has developed. Using the visual metaphor of a swimming pool, the MS Topography app presents easy-to-understand dynamic visualizations of how MS can develop over time, especially when it's left untreated. The app is not only educational, it is a great tool that can spur important conversations between you and your treating neurologist or MS specialist. Dr. Lublin, Dr. Krieger, it's a pleasure to welcome you both to the podcast.
Thanks for having us, John.
Many of my listeners are young enough that they've never known a time when MS was considered untreatable. So I'm hoping we can help them better appreciate what that time was like. Dr. Lublin, in the 1980s and early 90s, not only were there no treatments for MS, but MRI machines, well, they only became commercially available in the 1980s. So even as we entered the 90s, they were not nearly as prevalent as they've become. How did a clinician arrive at a diagnosis of MS then? And what happened next? What was the conversation with the patient like?
Well, before MRI scans, the diagnosis was entirely clinical. And it's what made for the diagnosis of multiple sclerosis was a multiple was more than one episode of neurologic problems involving the central nervous system. And it had to involve more than one area of the central nervous system. And we still employ that in the diagnostic criteria. What's different from the mid to late 80s onward was we found that MRI scan was even more sensitive to what was going on with MS than a patient was in terms of feeling something. So the MRI became an extremely useful tool, one that nothing before it came close to accomplishing. And because of that, they were incorporated into the diagnostic criteria that are known as the McDonald criteria, which have been updated several times. And the other point, of course, was important that MS wasn't a treatable disease. It would cause considerable disability, and there was very little we could do about it. We would treat acute attacks with corticosteroids of one sort or another, but the outlook was not particularly optimistic. And that's something, of course, that's changed dramatically now.
Certainly has. Dr. Krieger, as you and Dr. Lublin point out in your paper, gaining FDA approval of Betaseron was a seminal event in the field of MS. It had a positive and profound impact on so many stakeholders in the MS community. It changed the mindset of patients because now there existed strategies for treating MS. Clinicians gained a new therapeutic area and a heightened interest in neuroimmunology. And it also changed how clinical trials for MS could be designed and implemented. Can you talk about how MS clinical trials were fundamentally changed as a result of the approval of the first DMT for MS?
Well, thanks, John. And absolutely, I think, as we wrote about in the paper, the successful pivotal trial of interferon beta really not only showed that there was a therapeutic opportunity for multiple sclerosis, it also paved the way for people to understand how success could be defined and how success could be achieved and replicated and then improved upon, you know, over and over again for the subsequent 30 years that brings us to this modern era. I joined the field as a fellow here at Mount Sinai under Dr. Lublin 15 years ago, precisely halfway between that first approval and now. And so when I joined, we had a small handful of medicines, but we could see where the field was going. And that ability to study relapsing MS with disease-modifying therapies tested first against placebo and then later against active comparators, first to show that these medicines work, and then later to show that they worked as well or better than other medicines that we had in this field, was really part of the reason I joined this subspecialty. There seemed to be so much optimism at that point, and I think that optimism has been borne out over the past 15 years, while we now have 20-plus medicines in multiple different categories, now both for relapsing and for progressive forms of the disease.
So when we look at that moment 30 years ago, it was not only a moment that ushered in a new therapy, but it really set the stage for how future therapies could be tested and gain regulatory approval, didn't it?
Well, it did. Prior to that event, there was very little interest in the part of pharmaceutical companies, biotechs, to study MS because there had never been a successful clinical trial of a disease-modifying therapy. And it wasn't clear that anyone knew how to do it and how to measure it. And so what's happened since, of course, is once you have success, success breeds success, And we have iteratively gotten better and better at studying the illness so that our clinical trials of this decade are better than the ones of the last decade and certainly better than the ones from the prior century. And that's allowed for all of these advances moving forward.
As I mentioned when I introduced you both, your paper not only reflects on the past, but also highlights where we are today and calls out some challenges that still lie ahead. Dr. Krieger, your paper reminds us that what you refer to as, I'll quote now, the moving front of early detection and disease modification was unimaginable 30 years ago. Can you explain how taking advantage of that moving front of early detection enables earlier intervention and what that means in terms of a patient's MS journey?
Absolutely. You know, we often talk about how the waiting rooms in MS centers and in neurology offices look different now than they did 30 years ago because so many more people in the MS community are able to walk and live and have, you know, a life of less obvious and less manifest disability. That has also affected how we've studied the disease. So first, the initial interferon trials and others of that era were done in people with rather advanced MS. As we then, as Dr. Loveland mentioned, utilized MRI in clinical practice, could make the diagnosis earlier. The concept of clinically isolated syndrome, the first attack of MS, you know, became essential. And then there were studies of our disease-modifying therapies, not in late MS, but in early first-event MS, in CIS. And that became the paradigm for treatment. And now, when you look at clinical trials being performed in the modern era, these are often people who have very early MS. And the thing that we've learned from that is the earlier we act with these disease-modifying therapies, the more they can modify the course of the disease. The sooner we can make that diagnosis, also as Dr. Loveland mentioned, through the refined McDonald criteria, the sooner we can make that diagnosis, the sooner we can initiate a therapy that's likely to work better, started earlier. And I think that's the moving front that I was referring to, getting earlier, sooner, justifying early diagnosis and early intervention, which I think offers people the greatest source of optimism for their future.
If I can quote again from your paper, quote, even as we celebrate the successes in studying and treating relapsing MS, the principal unmet therapeutic need today can be summarized in two words, disease progression. It is the best of times and still the worst. For the patient in the clinic with early relapsing MS, the treatment opportunities are numerous, the prognosis optimistic. For the patient with advanced progressive MS, all of those vaunted successes fall away, and it is almost like 30 years ago all over again. End quote. Well, as someone whose wife lived with advanced progressive MS, I can sadly but easily concur with your observation. Dr. Loveland, are you seeing progress being made in better understanding the mechanisms that drive disease progression?
Yeah, there's a major coordinated international effort to address the challenges of progressive MS. And you know this because you're involved with it as well, as are many of the rest of us. It's not easy. It is a difficult challenge. But I think a lot of headway is being made both at the basic science level and also at the clinical trial level. And one of the things that's been notable in advancing MS therapies is that while we like to think of them having come from basic science through early trials, through late trials and proof of concept and such, a lot of what we learned has been doing a clinical trial of what we hope will be a promising agent, having it succeed, and then reverse engineering to see why it succeeded. And then meeting somewhere in the middle with the basic scientists. So there's lots to be done, but there is a tremendous amount of work being done. And I'm encouraged. It's not an easy task, but I am encouraged that we are going to make progress.
Well, Dr. Fred Loveland and Dr. Stephen Krieger, thank you for the remarkable contributions you've each made to our understanding of MS. Thank you for the work you continue to do to unravel the rest of the riddle and improve the lives of people affected by MS. And thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having us, John.
Thank you.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. You can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/305. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into your email or text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll take a moment and download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.